This book, Collected Poems, is not yet available online. These are four poems from, as you can see, two consecutive pages, all of which are closely related in substance to the poem that we have just been reading. And if we practice Sri Aurobindo's yoga poetry, it can be very similar to a daily or a weekly visit to the Mata Mandir chamber. You can take a canto of Savitri or one or two or three or four short poems dealing with a certain spiritual consciousness and just immerse yourself in those poems for a half an hour or an hour, and you're transported into a completely different vibrational range. So it can be a practice, like going to the Mata Mandir occasionally to become transparent. And I have no doubt that Sri Aurobindo intended that. Because his poems are, as we'll see tonight, attempts to capture a certain vibration that carries a consciousness of a reality. And he has concentrated on various planes and types of experiences in his poems. And so we will know at a certain moment that we have received that intention. And then you can go back to it and gradually familiarize yourself with that way of seeing. And it's very specific. So each of these poems is closely related, and those who have read The Silence and Beyond the Silence a few times and perhaps even tried to analyze it in terms of poetic feat, hopefully both quantitative and accentual, because if you haven't done both, it means you haven't read it. Does everybody know what I mean when I say that?
Doing that sentence from the beginning, if you...
If you have tried to analyze the poem according to its poetic meter, feet, that poem, which for the last 2 weeks we were studying, and if you have not analyzed it in terms of its quantitative meter as well as its accentual meter, then you have not read it. Your eyes have looked at it and your mind has thought about it, but as Sri Aurobindo has been telling us for weeks now, the quantitative meter can only be known by the ear. And only when the ear is really hearing the rhythm. And when the ear really hears the rhythm, then you can mark the quantitative feet of the poem, of the lines. So there are different structural levels that can be grasped. And then beyond those, there is the form and the substance. So at some point tonight, I'm going to flip to one of the chapters of the future poetry, and we can get a brief introduction to the form and the substance. But understanding the rhythm of the poem means hearing the poem. And when you have heard it, you can mark the quantitative measures. And they are more important than the accentual measures. And so if you have done that, then you are pretty familiar with this poem by now. Would somebody like to read number one?
Into the silence forever. Faced and immobile, formless and marvelous, higher than heaven, wider than the universe, in the pure glory of being, in the bright stillness of self-seeing, communing with the boundlessness, voiceless and intimate, make the knowledge
the computer just went blank.
No, you're fine. The computer just hibernated. Is that out
of
the table?
You said
die.
It's die. Couldn't bear that. It won't stay on.
No, it was this actually. It was better.
Yeah, but you have to also scroll down because she came to the last line.
Yeah.
I also thought it was so.
And the word vast, V-A-S-T? Vast. That the first word in that immobile and thy.
Okay. Formless and marvelous,
yeah,
higher than heaven.
Okay, so far it's going well. Start with vast and immobile.
Okay. Vast and immobile, formless and marvelous, higher than heaven, wider than the universe, in pure glory of being, in bright stillness of self-seeing, communing with the boundlessness, voiceless, and intimate, make thy knowledge too high for thought, thy joy too deep for emotion, at rest in unchanging light, mute with the wordless self's vision, spirit pass out of thyself, soul escape from the clutch of nature. All thou hast seen passed from thee, O witness. Turn to the alone and the absolute. turn to the eternal, be only eternity, peace and silence, or world transcending, nameless, oneness, spirit, immortal.
Okay, the spirit immortal is the object of the. So this is a command. When you get to the last two words, you have gotten to the pinnacle, not to the bottom. The only eternity, peace and silence. O world transcending, nameless, oneness, spirit immortal. So try to keep in mind the last session and the way the Katupanishad ended this evening. Try very hard to recall exactly those last few lines of the Upanishad.
Castle.
The idea of the self, of the eternal, of the bodiless in bodies, the established in things unsettled, the Om. Try to remember the Om as a state of being which is neither the born or the unborn, vast and immobile, formless and marvelous, higher than heaven, wider than the universe, in a pure glory of being, in a bright stillness of self-seeing, communing with a boundlessness, voiceless and intimate. Make thy knowledge too high for thought, thy joy too deep for emotion. At rest in the unchanging light, mute with the wordless self-vision. Spirit, pass out of thyself. Soul, escape from the clutch of nature. All thou hast seen, cast from thee. O witness, turn to the alone and the absolute. Turn to the eternal. Be only eternity. Peace and silence. O world transcending, nameless oneness, spirit immortal.
That spirit immortal is now in understanding,
no? No, they are positives.
O world transcending, nameless oneness. That is spirit immortal.
No. They're all equal epithets.
They're all equal epithets.
Spirit immortal. Be that. Be spirit immortal.
Be nameless.
Be oneness. Be peace. Be eternity. Be the world transcending nameless oneness, spirit immortal. It's a command. So when you read this poem, you need to tell that to yourself. You are instructing or receiving instruction. It's not passive. Into the silence. Into the silence. Arise, O Spirit immortal, away from the turning wheel, breaking the magical circle. You can't arise into the silence unless you break the circle of sensation. It's a transformation. I'm going to go on to the next page now. So, that's the first movement, which should accomplish what the Katha Upanishad was trying to accomplish. You throw everything into the fire. You accept only the immortal self, the one, the eternal, the immortal in everything. So you concentrate completely on that aspect of reality, not all of the ordinary aspects of reality, until you resonate with the idea of spirit. Spirit is something. Spirit is perceptible. It's not something outside us. So you bring your consciousness to spirit presence, spirit consciousness, by turning away from all of the other possible objects of consciousness. And you find yourself in the silence, and everything is silent, even the noise. Because this silence is not an audible silence. Sri Aurobindo says in the synthesis of yoga, we shall know that, capital T, Tat. We shall know that in our yoga as the silence. So the key here is that self is actually unmoving, unchanging, not capable of reacting to anything. And it is in everyone, it is a continuous type of being, self. So when you experience that, it's in you and me and him and her and all this. Self is a continuum of stillness, of silence. That's what he wants us to identify with.
Not capable of reacting or not reacting?
Not capable of reacting. There's a key word here. Formless. 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 Self is formless. Immobile. When the yogi uses the word immobile, he means absolutely motionless. If anything is absolutely motionless, then it is not capable of reacting to anything. anyway, it is everything. So it has no need to react to anything.
But that's what I felt, and therefore the capability idea.
So there may be some reactions in the field, but they're not reactions of the self. This is the secret of the witness Purusha. It can be separated totally from Prakriti. Which doesn't mean that Prakriti falls into non-existence. Sri Aurobindo raises that question in his commentary on the Gita. So according to Sankhya, if you remove the witness, the self from Prakriti, it should collapse, it should cease to exist because it doesn't have a sanction. But that's not the case, it continues. So the transformation of consciousness is a movement into another vibrational plane, the plane of stillness, the plane of immobility and formlessness, the plane of spirit, which is immortal. So he's pushing towards that from within.
But he has the spirit in the silence.
The spirit is the silence.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. It's an identity. Then, let's move to number two. Number two is much more dynamic than number one. Sri Aurobindo says in his letters of 1930-32 that overmind poetry is the product of the higher consciousness using the vital. Yes. Using the vital. So we'll see some more commentary on that in a moment. The reason why I'm saying it now is that this silence that he's talking about is not a disappearance. From the Katha Upanishad we learned that it's the I. It is the soul that is experiencing this bodiless in bodies, this eternally established in the changing and unsettled. It's a state of soul, purusha, witness, awareness of an essence that's not separate from all this. But it's a different quality. So, when he moves beyond it, then it becomes something else. Out from the silence. Out from the silence. Carry with thee the ineffable substance. Ineffable substance. Spirit. Immortal. The Om. Out from the silence. Out from the silence. Carrying with thee the ineffable substance. Carrying with thee the splendor and wideness, ascend, O Spirit immortal, assigning to time its endless meaning. Blissful, enter into the clasp of the timeless. Blissful, enter into the clasp of the timeless. This is a dynamic movement. I'm sorry to be so loud, but...
Yes, it's in the past.
Vibrations are felt.
Awake! Awake in the living eternal! Taken to the bosom of love of the infinite. Live self-found in His endless completeness. Finding the self, that's what Nachiketas is after. Live self-found in His endless completeness, drowned in His joy and His sweetness. Thy heart close to the heart of the Godhead forever. Vast, God-possessing, embraced by the wonderful, lifted by the all-beautiful into His infinite beauty. Let me suggest that the final syllable doesn't drop on any of these lines. Illimitable, illimitable, not illimitable. Omniscient, not omniscient. Because that's how it scans. That's the quantitative strength of the line. Love is endless and fathomless. It's not endless and fathomless. And this is a matter of equal strength given to each epithet. It's not about the ending of a line. It's about the lifting of the line into a level of equality of epithets. So love and fathomless and illimitable are all equally weighted. And so Sri Aurobindo speaks about quantitative weight and giving the full weight to the most important full concept. So when you do that, then you transmit something in the word itself. Then fathomless becomes fathomless. It's no longer the word fathomless. It becomes fathomlessness. It becomes illimitableness. The word illimitable is almost inconceivable. So when you raise the vibration of illimitable to the level of your consciousness of what illimitability might mean, then the line is carrying the meaning. And it's not the mind's abstract notion of what it might mean. And this is the whole difference. So start with love.
Love shall envelop thee, endless and fathomless, joy unimaginable, ecstasy illimitable, knowledge omnipotent, might omniscient, light without darkness, truth that is dateless.
That's good, because it's a period there. So then you do get to the end of I wouldn't call it a sentence, I would call it a packet of power. You come to the end of the packet of power, and then you have to take a deep breath and start the next one. And the next one doesn't drop, the next one goes even up another step. One with the transcendent.
There's a crescendo in the course.
There is a crescendo, definitely. And when you say the word one, allow your consciousness to encompass all of us and all of it and everything and even beyond everything.
One with the transcendent, calm, universal, single and free, yet innumerably living, all in thyself, and thyself in all dwelling. Act in the world with thy being beyond it. Soul, exceed life's boundaries. Spirit, surpass the universe. Outclimbing the summits of nature, transcending and uplifting the soul of the finite, rise with the world in thy bosom. A word gathered into the heart of the ineffable.
Okay, now this line is that to whom he is speaking. Because there is the Om, don't forget. And this is it. And in the mantra, it's known in tradition that there is a sacred syllable behind the passage of syllables. And so when you, from O word down to spirit immortal, we need to hear the Om vibrating behind these lines. A ring, a tone. So that last sentence has to be given a position of immediate response to whoever is giving this command. O Word, gathered in the heart of the ineffable. Because the Word has become gathered in this movement. Then read the last four lines with that idea that they all flow as one line.
One with the eternal, live in his infinity, drowned in the absolute, found in the Godhead, swan of the supreme and spaceless ether, wandering winged through the universe, spirit immortal.
One with the eternal, live in his infinity, drowned in the absolute, found in the Godhead, swan of the supreme and spaceless ether, wandering winged through the universe, spirit immortal. There is a drive in the it's called the quantitative weight distribution.
That's also from the right weight distribution.
No, it does come like that.
You should make a piazza play with Maxim and the others and say, I'd like to do that.
And at each, I mean, this is Sri Aurobindo's style, you know, and he uses it all the time. It's not unusual for him to be insistent in this way. It's the idea of strength. The rhythm of the poetry builds with strength towards a enlarging of consciousness. The divine uplift, he calls it. And for him, it's not something abstract. The divine uplift, you know, that doesn't mean mosquito floating towards the ceiling. You know, the divine uplift is something that fills you up and lifts you out of your normal awareness of things. I mean, he don't forget, you know, he has been practicing this supramental yoga for 20 years, pulling this force down into his body, and there is nothing else but that. It's illimitable energy. And so he's conveying that. This is his experience, you know, and so we need to take that, we need to be very aware that Sri Aurobindo's poetry is about energies, qualities, ideas that are beyond our normal range. So, I want to read a couple of sonnets, but first, there's a commentary towards the end of the Future Poetry in a chapter called The Form and the Spirit. And it's on page 277 in the Future Poetry. So we'll just... you can look at it up here. You don't need to have a book. 266 should be quite close now. No, but too far. So where are we now?
close.
No, we're getting close.
There.
So this paragraph, in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is speaking about the lyrical being the basis of all poetry. The lyrical impulse is the original and spontaneous creator of the poetic form. Song, the first discovery of the possibility of a higher, because a rhythmic intensity of self-expression. Higher because rhythmic. It wells out from the intensity of touch. Now, what could that possibly mean? This is a poetry which is sensuous. It wells out from the intensity of touch. It's a passion for music and song and expression. It's not some quietistic trance state thing, production. It's lyrical poetry, okay? And the spiritualized emotion of a more delicate or a deeper and more penetrating sight and feeling in the experience captures and sustains the inevitable cadences of its joy or its attraction, sets the subtle measure of its feeling and keeps it by the magic of its steps in sound, vibrating on the inner strings and psychic fibers. So it has to create that vibration of touch, which then stays in the subtler levels of the being. But first, it's dynamic expression through rhythmic sound. So, in a way, you cannot even pay attention to the meaning of the words. I mean, the first time you heard Bob Dylan, did you listen closely to the words? Probably not. The lyric is a moment of heightened soul experience, sometimes brief in a lightness of aerial rapture, in a poignant ecstasy of pain, of joy, or of mingled emotion, or in a swift, graver exaltation. A grave exaltation? What on earth could that be?
I'm curious.
Well, when the lyric becomes epic, you have grave exaltation, because power and destruction exalt you, but they're very serious. Sometimes prolonged and repeating, or varying the same note, sometimes linking itself in a sustained succession to other moments that start from it or are suggested by its central motive. It is at first a music of simple melodies coming out of itself, to which the spirit listens with pleasure and makes eternal by it the charm of self-discovery or of reminiscence. And it may rest satisfied, but it also, look down here, may assume an epic elevation. So I wanted to also switch to another similar description on page close by here, 282. Just to give you an idea of what Sri Aurobindo is thinking about when he thinks about poetry. look at this phrase at the top. Sheer directness of touch and vision. But that's not the passage. I want to go down to chaos. Out of chaos. Where is it? Yeah. The intimate and intuitive poetry of the future will have on the one side all the inexhaustible range and profound complexities of the cosmic imagination, of which it will be the interpreter. And to that it must suit 100 single and separate and combined and harmonic lyrical tones of poignantly or richly moved utterance. Imagine harmonizing in sound all the richness of cosmic emotion. That's Sri Aurobindo's idea of the poetry of the future, which he wrote. This is written before Savitri. And on the other, it will reach those bare and absolute simplicities of utter and essential sight, in which thought sublimates into a translucidity of light and vision, a translucidity of light and vision. Whoa.
Why not transparent?
Feeling passes beyond itself into sheer spiritual ecstasy. That's what he's trying to achieve in those poems that we just read. Not the idea of that, the touch of it. Feeling passes beyond itself into sheer spiritual ecstasy, and the word rarefies into a pure voice out of the silence. So the silence becomes the background of the sonic subtleties and tonalities. But they're always there on the background with the silence in the background. But not the silence in the foreground. So establishing that silence that was in that poem, that immobility, that touch of immortality, is the background for this intuitive exploration of all the subtleties of existence. And there are no reactions in that. There's only bringing to light everything that is there in existence, painful or joyful, beautiful or terrible.
There is deep spiritual emotion.
Yes.
Spiritual ecstasy.
And look at this, the sight will determine the lyrical form, Pashyanti Vak. The sight will determine the lyrical form and discover the identities of an inevitable rhythm. Okay. Identities of an inevitable rhythm. So each of those epithets, which he names in the line, is an identity. And you know that it's an identity because of its rhythmic equality. each one comes up from, in terms of pitch and accent, each of those epithets comes up to a level at which they are one. But if you don't bring out that oneness by the rhythm, then it seems that they all have an equality with some monotony, some level of monotony. But their oneness is not at a level of monotony. Their oneness is at a level of power, of vastness, of beauty and limitlessness. So each of those words carries that limitlessness. And then, of course, the prerequisite of this, a spiritual change must come over the intention and form of the drama when once the age has determined its tendencies. So what he's saying here is that this evolution of poetry eventually goes beyond the lyrical and the epic into drama. And then drama, which he builds into most of his longer poems, is the confrontation of one principle with another, of this God with that God, or this leader with that follower, or with that God. And so then there are these polarities that are built up of dramatic tension. And where does that tension come from? It comes from the sound of their voices. You can hear their opposite values and their opposite concerns, and they get resolved through this interplay of emotional expression. But it comes through the rhythm. It doesn't come by a changing of your attitude or your pretending that you're some different person. It comes through the rhythm itself. So then, with respect to the poems that we just read, I think we can turn that off. I passed out four sonnets that convey the same ideas as the Upanishad and as the poem Ascent. So let's look on page 143. What is it? See, here again, we have the witness spirit. But this is a different form. This is a sonnet, and it has a very regular rhyme scheme. But it has this I to which the Katupanishad was speaking. This I, which is the soul that has performed this sacrifice. I dwell in the spirit's calm, nothing can move, and watch the actions of thy vast world force, its mighty wings that through infinity move, and the time gallopings of the deathless horse. This mute, stupendous energy that whirls the stars and nebulae in its long train, like a huge serpent through my being curls, with its diamond hood of joy and fangs of pain. It rises from the dim, inconscient deep, upcoiling through the minds and hearts of men, then touches on some height of luminous sleep the bliss and splendor of the eternal plane. All this I bear in me, untouched and still, assenting to thy all-wise, inscrutable will.
Still ascending, you paused after still. It's the end of the line. But
yes, untouched and still.
And still ascending.
No, untouched and still.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
There is a little bit of enjambment, but it's not there. There is enjambment in the second line of the second stanza. Whirls the stars. So in the poem that we read before, the witness, he was asking, who art thou? Who art thou that is motionless and yet wills somehow all this? Now he is in that position himself, fully. I dwell in the spirit's calm, nothing can move. If you read that line to yourself affirmatively a few times, you begin to identify with it. I dwell in the spirit's calm, nothing can move. And watch the actions of thy vast world force, its mighty wings that through infinity move, and the time gallopings of the deathless horse. If you can learn to see the vital world that you live in as that deathless horse moving through everything all the time, then you transform your perception of the vital world from a perception of weakness to a perception of strength. And at the same time, you're completely aloof from it. Now I want to drop down to the last one, the hidden plan. However long night's hour, I will not dream that the small ego and the person's mask are all that God reveals in our life scheme, the last result of nature's cosmic task. It conveys some determination, some intention to endure. However long night's hour, I will not dream that the small ego and the person's mask or all that God reveals in our life scheme, the last result of nature's cosmic task. A greater presence in her bosom works, long it prepares its far epiphany. Even in the stone and beast, the Godhead lurks, a bright persona of eternity. It shall burst out from the limit traced by mind and make a witness of the prescient heart. It shall reveal, even in this inert blind nature, long veiled in each inconscient part, fulfilling the occult magnificent plan, the worldwide and immortal spirit in man. This is just a matter of semantics. He's watching the actions of the vast world force, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Its mighty wings, that's one thing he's watching, moving through infinity. And he's watching the time gallopings of the deathless horse.
Okay.
The mighty wings are the soaring mind and intelligence and imagination and that create things, and the deathless horse is what carries it into manifestation. What's embodied in these two poems is the everyday life of Sri Aurobindo. This is not just casual poetry. This is the sadhana.
Somebody said Jesus.
Pardon?
Somebody what said Jesus.
That's what I said.
Somebody said
Jesus.
Jesus.
No, he said, this is the everyday life of Sri Aurobindo. And I said, Jesus,
Jesus.
that's quite everyday life. That's what I meant.
No, I didn't say Jesus.
Sorry, it's a Western thing. I could say gosh, or dart, or man.
And the big difference with this and Jesus is that
Jesus didn't write so much poetry.
Jesus didn't instruct his followers to aspire to this realization. He instructed his followers to accept poverty and simplicity so that there could be a resurrection after death. This is quite...
It was wisdom. In those days it was the supreme
right.
wisdom.
Which undoubtedly is good for the soul. At a certain stage.
Well, we also reached humanity.
But, you know, when we get to the other page, there's Sri Aurobindo has a different slant on this. which we won't do right now, but here he says, the world's happiness flows through me like wine. It's the second stanza of the first poem on the other page.
Flows like wine, there we go.
I contain the world, the wide world, in my soul's embrace. In me Arcturus and Belphegor burn. To whatsoever living form I turn, I see my own body with another face. All eyes that look on me are my soul eyes. The one heart that beats within all breasts is mine. The world's happiness flows through me like wine. Its million sorrows are my agonies. Yet all its acts are only waves that pass upon my surface, inly forever still. Unborn, I sit, timeless, intangible. All things are shadows in my tranquil glass. My vast transcendence holds the cosmic world. I am hid in it as in the sea a pearl. And so we have this image also from the Upanishad of the hidden, it wasn't an image of a pearl, but it was some other
but also unborn.
But as a corn, you mean as a
yeah, like the corn seed in the husk.
In the inside of me.
You know what I've noticed as far as the rhymes go?
Yeah, there's a rhyme scheme.
There is a rhyme scheme, and in the second stanza, eyes should theoretically rhyme with
agonies.
Like in Tiger Tiger Burn.
No, but that's a false rhyme.
Yeah.
What Sri Aurobindo does is he picks up the final eyes, agonies. Okay, and that's a good example of how different the quantitative meter is from the ordinary accentual meter, you know. Then you would have some kind of artificial, are my soul eyes, are my agonize. This is not country music.
You know? You are still at
no, it's the O.
I get it that it's the O.
Is English a word or is it
a word? It's not a word.
Take it from Sri Aurobindo. It's a word. And he uses it quite a lot.
He has many words. He has coined many words in English.
So
that's
his coin or is it
a word?
Is
it a new word? Is it a new word? Is it a new word?
No, it's common in an older form of English.
Inside
of me, no. Yeah.
In inside of me.
Within me.
Within.
It's an adverb.
No, inwardly. Well, inwardly.
It's an adverb. It's not a preposition.
Born with, but we go in there in French. Born with, in there.
I mean, he's not going to sacrifice the rhythm for the sake of grammar. So he could say innately. What line is that?
Third stanza, second line.
Yeah, third stanza, second line. Upon my service, Italy forever still.
I love that word, actually.
It's a inly forever still, unborn, I sit. He could say within.
No, inly sounds perfect.
Within forever still.
No,
but he wants to have the.
No, it's better because there is the unborn after.
He wants to have the accent on the second syllable. Inly. It's the weight. Inly forever still.
This inly in German resembles to innerlich. Somebody understands German.
Anyway, with Wordsworth, and Sri Aurobindo gets a lot of good ideas from Wordsworth, you have this word used quite normally. So there is a section in both this chapter and in the quantitative meter regarding some other poets' uses of these principles, and Sri Aurobindo is very positive towards them as expressions of emotions that really carry the emotion, even though the level is not so high. It's not spiritual poetry, but it's poetry which effectively uses the principle of quantitative meter, and which also employs this idea that that lyrical poetry has the power to carry the real experience of the soul and not just an image of it. So next time we can read a little bit of that and then take some poems from Shelley and from Wordsworth and see how their word music compares with Sri Aurobindo's. Because he actually spent a great deal of time with the romantic poets. He speaks about them all the time here. And yeah, there's a whole book called On Quantitative Meter, which is after the body of the future poetry. So we've been going over, we've gone through many pages of that essay. It starts on page 317 of the future poetry and goes on to 390. Yeah, I would encourage you to read the whole of the future poetry.
Excellent. I'll put it online to read.
But especially this chapter, The Form and the Spirit, and the Word and the Spirit.
Form and Spirit, Word and Spirit.
We can learn a lot from those two chapters.
How about the power and the spirit? Not yet.
It comes before those, right?
Yes, that's
not so important.
Okay.
For our current pursuits.
276.
The form and the spirit is 276, and the word and the spirit follows it.
And it's very interesting to me that is cool, we have some meditation. And the kids read like in English and French. It's so hard.
But,
Thank you. Good night.